I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Americans are reacting to a former president's statement on race. We're going to have more on that today. But first, the current president is heading to the University of Maryland College Park tomorrow to try to bring the spotlight back to health care and bring his core supporters, young people, back as well. Today, the long-awaited health care proposal from Max Baucus's Senate Finance Committee was officially released without any Republican committee members supporting it. And like the other bills floating around Congress, it requires all Americans to buy insurance. And that mandate is something that's going to affect the young people Obama hopes to woo tomorrow. Americans under 30 make up a sizable amount of the country's uninsured, people who either can't afford insurance or who don't want it because they think they don't need it. Shayla Murray is national political correspondent for The Washington Post. And Shayla, you write that ironically, this group of young adults has been silent on the issue of health care reform, even though they're such a critical component and were such big backers of candidate Obama. So why are they so important?
Well, they're really important because their participation is central to the whole idea of health care reform. They have to get into these insurance pools in order to lower the cost of insurance for older, sicker people.
Right, they're going to help pay for it.
Oh, they're going to effectively be subsidizing their parents. And one of the reasons that costs are so out of control right now is because the younger, healthier, or just healthier people in general, they either don't buy insurance or they buy too little insurance. So the insurance industry or the government through Medicare and Medicaid are saddled with these, you know, older or poorer or sicker people. And then you have these, you know, the freeloaders under 30.
Well, and this group of uninsured has been dubbed the young invincibles because they think they are invincible. Most young people do. And they don't need as much health care. But you're right. This is ironic because many do stand to benefit. Explain why. I mean, kids, for instance, are dropped from parents' policies.
Well, they're dropped from parents' policies, and oftentimes kids will have conditions, for instance, sports injuries in high school, you know, the knee that just doesn't get better. And then in maybe they're 24 or 25, a couple years out of college, don't have a job yet from, you know, an employer that doesn't provide coverage to them, and they need knee surgery. Well, that's tens of thousands of dollars out of their own pocket if they don't have coverage.
Or they may not get coverage because they have pre-existing conditions.
Exactly. And apparently a lot of the cheaper policies will write conditions like that right out of the coverage. And I talked to one woman in New York yesterday who is a cancer survivor, was diagnosed 3 months before she graduated from college and was dropped by her father's insurance the day she left school and has been struggling on the open market for 4 or 5 years now, and paying huge premiums. She lives in New York where insurers are required to cover pre-existing conditions, but she pays these huge premiums for very little coverage. And those are the kind of stories that you hear all over the country from people of all different ages.
Well, most of the new proposals would also require insurance agencies to cover people with pre-existing conditions.
Oh, that's one of the biggest priorities, right?
So that would benefit young people. And Senator Baucus is, as expected, also offering a bare-bones policy that would be cheaper for young people, but also let them, you know, abide by the mandate that they would have to buy something. And so we understand that this would be just for catastrophic care. But we're wondering, you know, the fines, an early draft of the Baucus plan called for $750 to $950 fines for people who didn't buy health insurance. Sound like they're still cheaper than the cheapest health plan that's being offered by maybe a couple hundred dollars. So do young people really, are they really going to have an incentive to buy insurance if the fine is cheaper?
Well, you know, we'll see, and that is a huge question. A lot depends on how it's answered. Right now, it looks like this young invincible plan, as they're calling it, which would cover catastrophic costs, but also some preventative care. That's sort of the carrot in the deal. And that would cost maybe around $100 a month. So at those prices, it would still be significantly more. So that's why at this event tomorrow at College Park and going forward, the president needs to speak directly to this group of people and enlist them not only in going door to door to convert people to support health care generally, but also to make their own investment in this new system and participate. I mean, they are really the linchpins of the whole formula eventually.
Shayla Murray is national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Shayla, thank you.
Thank you.
Yesterday, we asked the question, is at least some of the recent rude public behavior also racist? A chorus of voices had said yes. Yesterday, the House, led by black Democrats, voted along party lines to rebuke Congressman Joe Wilson for shouting, "You lie," at the president. Maureen Dowd wrote in her Sunday New York Times column that when she heard that phrase, she heard it as, "You lie, boy," reminding us of when Congressman Jeff Davis said of then-candidate Obama, "That boy's finger doesn't need to be on the nuclear button." Of course, there are Americans with legitimate criticisms of Obama, and Republican Party Chair Michael Steele said today that President Carter is flat-out wrong that criticism is based on racism. But death threats against Obama have increased 400% over past presidents, and now former President Jimmy Carter has weighed in.
An overwhelming portion of the intensely demonstrated animosity toward President Barack Obama is based on the fact that he is a black man.
It's been a week of incivility, attributed to everything from living in a Twitter age to celebrity meltdowns. But the former president has put race front and center, so let's start there. Will Haygood is Washington Post Style Section reporter. Will, a personal reflection first. You're also African-American. You report, though, on a range of issues. But what was your reaction when you heard what President Carter had to say?
It was wow. Many, many, many African-Americans are fearful that so much has gone unsaid. I think there's a feeling that it was long overdue and about time.
Well, I listened to a lot of cable TV last night after Carter's statement. Republicans like Mark Williams of the Tea Party, the anti-tax, anti-health care reform movement, admitted that there is a fringe that this thinking applies to, but he says it's just a fringe. But yet this is the same person who spit out in a moment of pique on CNN a while back that Obama was an Indonesian Muslim. So what are the kinds of things that African-Americans have been hearing that seem to them like a steady drumbeat?
There's a feeling that Obama does not get the benefit of the doubt, realizing that, hey, he's been in office only 8 months.
Are you saying that the anger is out of proportion to his time in office and his actions?
Absolutely.
And a reported 53% of Republicans, according to Daily Cause, don't think Obama was born here. It translates on placards sometimes to, you know, he's not one of us. Is that also seen as, you know, being another language for race?
Well, yes. And I think that those who cannot believe it, understand it, or never wanted it to happen in the first place, that they always look under rocks for these bizarre, you know, rumors that they think are facts.
Well, we want to talk more about race and incivility with our next guest. We're going to do that. But meanwhile, also in the last week, there's been threats to cause bodily harm with a tennis ball, Kanye West's unappreciated shout-out at the MTV Video Awards. What are people telling you about that?
We live in a different age now. Say in the 50s, record companies, movie studios had their artists under contract, and they were told, be good. Don't do anything to embarrass your record label. For some reason, all that now mostly has been tossed aside.
Media studies professor Toby Miller, he's at the University of California, focused more on the town hall meetings, and he says that organizations encouraging bad behavior represent something different.
He makes a good point, and I think in the past year with the economic meltdown we've had, maybe there's a feeling that everything is off the table, that I'm for myself and my family and I can say anything. Just the feeling out there that things have gotten unhinged.
How is that watched by black America?
With both fear and worry, with the feeling that it's nothing new. Large crowds, overwhelmingly white, many, many, many mean-spirited people. Many blacks saw that as an expression of a sentiment that has not yet died.
What do you think happens now? You covered Obama on the campaign. You say you were impressed by how nimble he was on the subject of race. Mm-hmm. Now a former president has placed it right on the table, exactly where the White House didn't want it.
I would expect that more members of his staff will be given some type of free rein to address the race issue. Black folk talk about it all the time. White America does not have to talk about it and thus will not talk about it.
Well, and do you think that black America talks too much about it? Rush Limbaugh says, you know, the answer to everything is race, and he's made that one of his clarion calls.
No, I think when you cover something up, I think it becomes infested with sores. they haven't been addressed. There's been no medicine put upon them. They haven't had time to heal. Nobody is saying all of America is racist. I think people think that there are pockets of extreme racial insensitivity. I think we have the highest office in the land, and the man who is holding that office is being talked about in very unfathomable ways, and I think there's a feeling amongst blacks that it should stop.
Will Haygood, Washington Post Style Section reporter. Will, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, and as we keep repeating, there are, of course, critics of President Obama with legitimate questions about, say, health care. But today, conservative leaders are saying that they've been called racist in the past for their criticism of the largely African-American activist group ACORN. And this week, devastating undercover video at ACORN centers in four cities showed workers encouraging people to skirt the law and, for instance, run prostitution rings. Conservatives point to that as validation that they are not racist in their accusations. Well, Chris Smith is a professor of communication at the University of Southern California. Professor Smith, first of all, your thoughts on President Carter's statement.
I think that if I were a member of the Obama administration, I would be feeling a little bit of trepidation about it, because now it does put the onus on you to kind of speak about it, and it wouldn't be good if they did. But in terms of black Americans, tremendous sense of relief and appreciation for former President Carter's candor. I felt for a long time that the conversation about race needs to happen primarily among white Americans.
Well, South Carolina Joe Wilson's son and wife have both come out and said there's not a racist bone in his body, but there's a perception that happens. Winthrop University political science professor Scott Huffman addressed that. He emailed us that whether he intended it or not, his outburst, Wilson's outburst, fits a familiar narrative. It's like when Georgia Congressman Lynn Westmoreland called Obama uppity during the campaign.
It's patently disrespectful. Never been done before. Any given statement becomes connected with previous historical patterns. Having their adulthood demeaned and infantilized, the effect is similar to so many other overtly racist acts. Following up on Will's suggestion of how the anxiety produced by the economic crisis is so important to this, and also our position in the world. I think a lot of the kind of alarm about Obama is not so much purely race-based. I think it's that people have an untethered anxiety about where America is going. And there are some racial elements to it, and I don't want to discount what Jimmy Carter said, but I think the larger picture is that we seem to be slipping as a superpower, and I think that that's what's making people very, very scared.
Chris Smith, professor of communication at the University of Southern California. When we come back, we're going to have more with the professor, including the question, how big a portion of the population is this, and is talking about it blowing it up too big? Back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about civility and race with University of Southern California communication professor Chris Smith, now that former President Jimmy Carter has put race front and center. And Professor, last night Rachel Maddow, on her program on MSNBC, went through a history of right-wing fringe hate groups with her guest Jonathan Alter of Newsweek. And they went from the Birchers through Father Coughlin and Joe McCarthy, pointing out that these vitriolic hate groups have always been with us and are fringe. You know, maybe 65,000 people on the mall this past weekend, many of them civil, but definitely not the 2 million that organizer conservative Glenn Beck claims there were. So is this being blown out of proportion?
No, absolutely not. This is a very dangerous climate we're in right now. We're waging two wars, one of which in Afghanistan, that's tenuous at best. We just celebrated, commemorated, I should say, the anniversary of 9/11. There are people out there in the world who still seek to do the United States harm. It is a dangerous environment to discredit the president like this.
But that's the same thing the right said in the run-up to the war in Iraq about the 500,000 people who protested that war.
Well, let's put it this way. it took comparatively a very long time, and no one alienated the president from his country. No one actually depicted him as a fascist figure. Look, the vitriol around President Bush is well known, but I think the point is it's reaching another level of dehumanization with President Obama.
Well, and as some have said, over health care reform and moves in the economy that were started under the Bush administration. So it doesn't, as Will Hagood just said to us, it doesn't seem to match, doesn't seem to fit. Jonathan Alter from Newsweek also pointed out last night that during some of these times that we mentioned, times of right-wing fringe groups, it was a Republican that led the charge against them. A Republican led the charge against McCarthy, for instance. Does it have to be Republicans today?
I think it should be any right-minded person, Republican, Democrat, Independent. I mean, let's put it this way as well. The thing that's so significant about President Carter's statement is he is trying to show how basic, banal, and everyday these type of racial, racist sentiments are. We do ourselves a disservice by purely identifying these anti-progressive sentiments on the far right fringe. These sentiments are a part of all of us. That's what's so profound about racial ideology. It is a normal part of everyday experience. In my daily life as a Black American, I have to do battle with racial ways of understanding the world within myself.
How so?
Well, because it's a fundamental way in which we make sense of the world. The same way we use nationality, sexuality, gender, and a whole range of other prisms through which we, you know, make the world intelligible. Race is a salient aspect of what we see in the world. When we see someone, we register their phenotypic difference. And the way in which we register that phenotypic difference according to other salient social factors, that's how race operates in the world. Sometimes it's for the good, sometimes it's indifferent, sometimes it's for the bad. And so I think what Jimmy Carter is doing that is profoundly productive work is to demonstrate that race operates through norms. It doesn't operate through the fringe. We like to think that we've got this situation under control because we can readily identify the fringe, we can talk about how small their numbers actually are, but in fact, this is more of a mainstream phenomenon than we think it is.
Well, there were two issues today on the table. One was race, the other civility. They cross, obviously, in some of these stories. But PM Fornai, who heads the Civility Institute at Johns Hopkins University, told USA Today that he thinks that all of these outbursts combined are great. His reaction was, you know, great. Now the notion of civility may be back on the national agenda. Do you agree? And race would seem to be a part of civility.
Well, I'm a communications professor, and I would just suggest that we're at a profoundly new moment in our cultural history where it is harder and harder to find the examples through which you teach the millennial generation the need for civility, why it's a civic virtue. It's very difficult to impress upon the millennial generation what civility is all about when so many pop cultural factors, so many mass technology factors indicate to them that have inculcated within them a whole new way of understanding how we're to engage with one another. I do think that to his credit, I think Barack Obama has been remarkably adept at providing a consistent and sustained approach to civility.
Well, and might we suggest you also point to Beyonce, who graciously invited Taylor Swift to take her, Beyoncé's, moment in the spotlight to make up for the one that Kanye West robbed Taylor of.
Yes, and that was wonderful for her to do. I think that one thing about Beyoncé is her family and her marketing apparatus, they are kind of old school in the way that they want Beyoncé to come across as America's sweetheart, America's princess, America's
they raised her right.
Century, you know, Emily Post, and they're doing a good job of it. I will say, though, one last point. I think it's dangerous to too quickly make an equivalent gesture between what went on in the pop realm over the weekend and what Joe Wilson did on the floor of Congress, because history is not going to recall Serena Williams' outburst to any significant degree. History is not going to recall Beyonce showing good graces to Taylor Swift. It's absolutely trivial to the pattern and course of history.
Yeah.
What Joe Wilson represents is far more is potentially far more significant by way of how we move forward from here as a country trying to address monumental and sweeping problems.
That moment will be in the history books. Chris Smith, professor of communication at the University of Southern California. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you.
Okay. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to take a look at the fight in science over who's responsible for science illiteracy in the U.S. Is it the scientists themselves? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, how green is your college? We'll be back after the latest news, Here and Now. Afghan election officials say that President Hamid Karzai has 54% of the presidential vote, but that's a preliminary count, and the UN is still examining thousands of potentially fraudulent ballots from last month's election. If, in the end, Karzai gets less than 50% of the vote, there will be a runoff election, and with the election results still up in the air, there could be a dangerous political deadlock. Neutral voices are talking of the need for compromise and flexibility, even a government of national unity, but some opposition supporters have warned of street protests if President Karzai is declared the winner. And that's added to an edgy mood in Kabul, as the BBC's South Asia correspondent Chris Morris found.
I'm on the edge of Kabul, standing in front of broken masonry and the remains of a shattered window. Nur Aziz is describing the night earlier this month when his brother and his brother's wife and child were killed by a rocket, presumably fired by the Taliban, which blew a hole in their bedroom wall as they slept. For the first 6 months of this year, Kabul felt pretty safe. But during this extended election season, there have been suicide bombs and these occasional rockets. Nur says everyone feels a little uneasy.
The situation in Kabul is bad. Just on that night, there were three rockets. One landed here, two over there. Security is not good. I'm 30 years old. All my life, it has always been war. I just want all Afghans to stop fighting.
Well, the authorities say security has been reviewed and tightened, but in these uncertain times, you can buy most things here in Kabul's markets if you know where to look. And that includes guns. We spoke to one trader who didn't want his voice recorded, so his words are spoken by someone else.
Prices have definitely gone up. We're selling a lot more weapons these days, but we're not sure exactly who's buying them or why. Some of it is private security companies, and local people have been buying handguns for their own protection. We've also been selling heavier weapons, like rocket-propelled grenades. People are stocking up.
This is the voice of Atta Mohammed, a powerful former warlord from northern Afghanistan and a prominent supporter of the main challenger in the presidential election, Dr. Abdullah. In this speech, he's accusing the Interior Minister, Hanif Atmar, of handing out weapons to government supporters. He also says people have the right to take to the streets in protest if they feel the election is being stolen from them. Mr. Atmar has reportedly threatened to break the teeth of anyone who demonstrates. But his spokesman, Zemurai Bashiri, is more measured.
Peaceful demonstration, peaceful rallies are the rights of the people. We will not let threats to harm the demonstrators. But those who are trying to do kind of riots under the name of demonstration, attack public properties, loot shops, and bring insecurity to the people of Afghanistan, these elements or these actions are completely prohibited in the law. They will not have the opportunity to do that.
So the Interior Ministry says it's ready to respond to any threat. But I've just been speaking to one very senior Afghan political figure who describes Kabul as a pile of dry wood waiting for a match. He says there are 20 criminal gangs in the city who would take advantage of political unrest to create chaos. Wadir Safi of Kabul University is less gloomy, but still concerned.
Full security didn't exist even before the elections. And especially these days, because the worsening relations between the candidates, especially two top candidates, the situation is getting day by day very tense, and The wealthy population of Kabul has already flown, and they have escaped to Dubai, mostly who are affiliated with the government, and those who are not also has taken out their capital as well.
There's plenty of building work going on in Kabul right now, but there's also an estimated 500,000 unemployed young men. So the fear is less of Iranian-style political protest and more of public disorder in a city with seething resentment just beneath the surface. It's another reason why the complaints process in this election, investigating claims of fraud, needs to be seen to be as thorough as possible, to avoid giving people who might seek to exploit public protest the chance to strike.
That report from the BBC's Chris Morris. Well, just ahead, how green should a college be? Students are increasingly saying very. In 30 seconds, here and now. A recent survey by the Princeton Review found that two-thirds of students applying to college say how green a school is plays a big part in whether they'll go there. And colleges are responding. Arizona State at Tempe has the first of its kind in the country, School of Sustainability. At Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, students collect fryer oil and use it to fuel campus cars. But the tiny College of the Atlantic, which operates on Mount Desert Island up in Maine and has less than 500 students, was founded in 1969 on the premise that green is good. It ranks fifth on Sierra Magazine's third annual list of the most eco-enlightened U.S. universities and is one of Princeton Review's greenest colleges of 2010. All of its students, all of them, major in human ecology, the study of our relationship with the environment. We're joined now by COA's president, David Hales. David, what are some of other things you do that you might not see on other college campuses?
We've had zero waste graduation ceremonies, which is a slight exaggeration because I believe that we actually ended up with about 4.5 pounds of total waste.
Yeah, but still.
All of our electricity comes from renewable energy. Almost 40% of our heating comes from renewable energy, primarily wood pellets, and our hope is to make that 100% by 2015. We have a wind generator on our farm, which produces the electricity that's necessary to operate that farm. We try to pay attention to what we do, in part because it's the right thing to do, but it's also a part of what we believe is a sustainable financial future.
Is it cheaper for you to be ecologically savvy?
Sure it is, and it is not only cheaper now, it will be much cheaper by the time we get out to 2025 or 2030. I'll say that any college or university that's not 100% dependent on renewable energy by 2030 for its electricity will have tuition going through the ceiling.
Huh. What's your tuition?
Our tuition, room and board, is around $40,000 a year.
Well, that's not inexpensive.
It's not inexpensive at all, but we're one of less than 300 colleges in the country that meets 98% of our students' federally certified need. About two-thirds of our students receive financial assistance from the college while they're here. And so the actual cost to a student is much less than that. The $40,000 reflects pretty much what it is our expense to provide the education that they receive.
Well, the kids also eat food that's locally grown. In fact, the college has a farm, and kids can work on that. You try to use biodegradable cleaning chemicals and office supplies that are environmentally responsible, but the kids also have an attitude. And you made a comment about how the New York Times noted that I think you have light switches that turn themselves off, but that's sort of redundant.
Well, we went through an energy survey from an energy service contractor who came in and suggested ways to achieve more energy efficiency. One of the things that they came in thinking they would recommend would be automatic light switches that would turn on when somebody was present. What they found here is that that would be a needless expense because the students themselves turn the lights off. So there's just from that to the recycling to the degree to which students walk where they go, their food preferences, all of those things tend to be consistent with the idea that humans have a responsibility for the world around them and that they can make a difference.
All your students study human ecology. You have no academic departments, no faculty ranks. Some would say, that's it. This is a sort of 60s retro, you know, hippies gathering on an island off of Maine. Of course it works well for you. This can't be duplicated.
Well, that will be a very interesting thing to see. A lot of colleges and universities have taken a look at the kinds of things that we do. And even in the midst of a very big university, you will find that they have an honors college, which approaches things much more the way we do than the way the general undergraduate education is taught at that same university.
And we noted Arizona State at Tempe has a new School of Sustainability. So you're saying schools are moving towards this, at least having programs. But how would, you know, let's say a commuter school or a community college where kids, you know, by and large are also just really trying to get an education while working. They've got a lot on their minds. And some would think that the green aspect or being aware of sustainability is a luxury, you know, that they can't afford. They're busy doing other things. And these schools are, you know, busy just trying to get as many kids through as they can. How can they do some of the things that you do?
I think that things we often see as luxuries for the rich are, in fact, necessities for the poor. And in the world of colleges and universities, we don't believe that just because we're small and do not have a massive endowment, that gives us a free pass on acting responsibly. And what we've found as we've done this is that it is part and parcel of the education that the students themselves receive, and that the green thing to do and the smart thing to do economically are more and more exactly the same thing.
Well, I'm thinking, too, these kids are going to be pretty well positioned for the demand for jobs in the green arena.
About two-thirds of our graduates within 2 years of their commencement will be in either professional school or in graduate school. About 20% will go on to be scientists, maybe another 17-18% find themselves in education, about that same number in public service, and a growing number are finding themselves as green entrepreneurs in the business world.
David Hales, he's president of the College of the Atlantic. It's ranked number 5 on Sierra Magazine's third annual list of the most eco-enlightened U.S. universities. But David, I'm just wondering, do you ever get the kid who comes up, the freshman, and just comes to you at some point and says, I can't take it anymore. I'm trying to think of what they might want to do. I got to get to a McDonald's. Get me off this island.
Not only do we get students who do that, faculty, I mean, we try to take our mission seriously, but not take ourselves all that seriously. And we really try to have fun as we go out at this. There's nothing essentially horribly purer than thou or sanctimonious about what we're trying to do. We really want to understand the relationship between humans and the worlds around them, the cultural world, the world of the imagination. And we think that the role of higher education is not just to help students understand the world in which they live, but to be able to shape the world in which they'll live the rest of their lives.
David Hales, again, of the College of the Atlantic up in Maine. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Take The Breakfast Club, add a dash of Revenge of the Nerds, and infuse it with the energy of High School Musical and the talent of Fame, and you have one of the most talked about new TV shows, Glee.
You put on quite a show, really had me going. Now it's time to go, curtains finally closing. That was quite a show.
The show on Fox follows the travails of high school Spanish teacher Will Schuster, played by stage actor Matthew Morrison, who yearns for former glory when he was in a glee club way back in the early 90s. The only problem, other teachers competing for resources are not thrilled with the idea of a new glee club.
You do with your depressing little group of kids what I did with my wealthy elderly mother. Euthanize it.
Ouch! That was the cheerleading coach. But fans disagree. The pilot premiered in the spring, then went on hiatus over the summer, giving time for the buzz to grow and fans to download the show's songs, some of the most popular downloads on iTunes. Brad Falchuk is one of the show's creators. He joins us from Los Angeles. Brad, welcome, and I guess congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Let's get with tone first. For the people who haven't heard it, your partners are Ian Brennan and Ryan Murphy, who created the very dark FX series Nip Tuck. Glee is not dark. It's more up with people, but through some sort of twisted lens. What is that lens? What was the tone you were going for?
You know, you said in your introduction something about The Breakfast Club, and there is a lot of, you know, I grew up with John Hughes, and there is a certain John Hughes inspiration to it in that there is darkness there. There are moments of great pain, which is sort of what high school is about, but we always wanted there to be hope that at the end, you know, something better would come along. We never leave you feeling too sad.
Well, let's tell people what a glee club is. A lot of viewers are going to identify with that idea of the magic of a high school singing group. I had a high school choir teacher, Mr. Cohen, and his students have formed a religion around him.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not a choir, and it's not a drama club. What is this glee club?
It's hard to describe. They perform songs as opposed to singing them.
Right.
They're not just dancing. They're not just singing. They're sort of dancing around and singing with a lot of sequins, usually. but there's a level of earnestness and commitment in all of these kids that do the show choirs that made it also very compelling.
Now, the Spanish teacher turned glee club leader, Will, holds tryouts. Let's listen to some of the voices.
My name is Mercedes Jones, and I'm singing R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Take care of TCP. Oh, hey, baby.
Hi, my name is Rachel Barry, and I'll be singing On My Own from the seminal Broadway classic Les Mis.
Fantastic. Let's hear it.
On my own, pretending he's beside me.
So, Brad, you're not going for the Simon Cowell American Idol, let's make fun of people because they can't sing.
No, quite the opposite. You know, one sort of rule we have, if you notice, people get made fun of a lot for a lot of things. When someone is singing or dancing, there is no irony there. We are just going for it in terms of the joy of it. And so, you know, we needed to have people that could really pull it off and that you could really get into when they were singing. So, you know, the kids we got and Matt are just immense talents because they can really sing and act.
Well, and that was Rachel, played by Lea Michele. Gorgeous voice, but also spends her spare time making videos on MySpace. She won her first talent competition, I think she says, at 3 months.
dance competition
at
3 months old, yeah.
That's right. It's almost like you're breaking some sort of fourth wall of irony as soon as they start performing.
Yes. The key is that, you know, it's hard to really dislike or look down upon somebody who's that talented, no matter how strange they are otherwise. But also at the same time, if someone is so talented and they become unlikable because they're also kind of charming and lovely outside of being talented, then it's kind of boring. It doesn't make for very good drama.
Another familiar storyline, and it happened in my choir, is that Will, the glee club director, has to recruit jocks to fill out the group. And he hears Finn, the school quarterback, played by Corey Monteith, singing in the locker room shower.
I'm getting closer than I ever thought I might.
Again, so talented. And a lot of the show is about a sort of a high school caste system. You've got your jock there, your nerds, drama geeks, cheerleaders. Where did you pull from high school here in the Boston area?
I went to a pretty small high school, but still there was a caste system there, and the athletic guys were on the top, and it sort of trickled down from there.
By the way, who were you in that caste system?
I, you know, have to admit, I literally was throwing kids in dumpsters every day. I'm ashamed to say it.
Because we should say this is something that the jocks were doing. That just, you know, sort of like the kid would say, hey, wait, let me take my coat off first. Then you throw me in the dumpster. You were doing that?
Yes, literally happened. Literally, that's taken directly from my life. And we just rained terror on there. I feel terrible about it. But I, you know, we've all grown up to be a little wiser and realize the error of our ways. And so maybe I'm, you know, there's a little therapy in showing it on TV now and showing how wrong we were.
Well, what about other caste systems? For instance, between schools, Will takes his glee club to another school that's going to have their show choir perform, and they are astonishing. They do Amy Winehouse's I Don't Want to Go to Rehab. Let's listen.
I look at glee as sort of as a sports show. In that, you know, you have this underdog team and they're going up and they compete against other teams and compete against each other and they're, you know, can they make it? It's Bad News Bears or Rudy or something. I would describe Vocal Adrenaline, which is the, you know, the team that does Rehab, as the New York Yankees. They're the evil empire. You know, they spend more than anyone else and they recruit from other schools and they cheat and they lie and they find every way they possibly can. And so they're the team everybody wants to beat. And so it's like, can our little ragtag bunch of misfits. Can they beat them?
Well, of course they can, unless unless the cheerleading coach stops them. We just have to note this. Sue Sylvester sees the Glee Club as her nemesis. She doesn't want anything to take the spotlight off her Cheerios, as she calls them. This is the great character actress Jane Lynch. Here are a few of her moments from the first two episodes.
You think this is hard? Try being waterboarded. That's hard.
My performers didn't get on Fox Sportsnet last year because they ate at Bacon Junction.
Since when are cheerleaders performers?
Your resentment is delicious.
That last exchange between Jane Lynch as the cheerleading coach and Jemma Mays, who plays an obsessive compulsive nutritionist.
Mm-hmm.
But all the teachers are having feuds over funding.
Well, the reality is, I know in Los Angeles, the arts funding is, there's basically no arts funding for public schools. Rather silly considering this is a city that is built on art and artistic expression. The show is really about the arts and the power of the arts and how the arts can change people's lives. You know, are we being political? I guess a little bit. Not intentionally too political, but it's definitely trying to say, like, look, these kids deserve something, and where's that money going? Of all the things it could go to, how could it not go to the arts programs?
Well, you did an interview with film school students, and you said the most important thing they had to do was find their own voice.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you hear your voice in Glee? Again, we were saying it's not fame. It's too nasty and cynical in parts for that, you know?
No, it's not.
What is it?
I think it's this idea that no matter how ridiculous things get, no matter how dark things get, that there's always a little chance that something's going to work out as long as you're expressing yourself. In all the characters, they're all struggling with that. When they do get hurt, it's so rewarding and so exciting.
Who said Hollywood was cynical? And
Perfect
segue for Journey's Don't Stop Believin'. It's a song that helps transform the Glee Club, a pivotal moment. It was apparently co-creator Ryan Murphy's idea. You didn't like it at first?
I was worried about it, but I was wrong. And every time I'm in an interview, I have to keep saying it. It's my penance for being so stupid. But I was wrong and he was right. And yeah, I just thought it might be a little too on the nose, and the Sopranos have done it, but no, it's perfect.
Brad Falchuk, one of the creators of Glee, which airs on the Fox Network on Wednesday nights. I will be sitting there waiting. Brad, thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.